Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for the dawn of America of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules, and at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. Banal of America's Summer of Strangeness continues tonight with an episode that I'm really looking forward to. It's one I've wanted to do for quite some time. I actually reached out to our guest tonight, John Tenney, like a long time ago, and we never... our paths never crossed, and then I got back on Twitter, and he's a prolific Twitterer, if that's the right word, and our paths started crossing all the time, as luck would have it, and then we had the chance to meet up at Lauren Coleman's Cryptozoology Conference up in Portland, Maine last April, and we hung out and had a blast, and since then, once I kind of got the wheels back on with Banal of America, I knew I wanted to get him on the show. For the folks who are unfamiliar with John Tenney, I'm going to have him give you sort of the informal bio background in a moment, but he's a researcher, lecturer. He really is kind of a jack of all trades with the paranormal. I'm really blown away by his depth of knowledge with all of these different fields. As anyone who listens to this show knows, I'm a fan of like all this different stuff. So to be able to talk to somebody who is really steeped in knowledge of all these different fields is I love folks like that. So. He's been involved with the paranormal, anomalistic, and spiritual research for over two decades. He's had a TV show. He's been in movies. He's been interviewed on podcasts. Obviously, we're doing this tonight. He's been on all kinds of radio shows. Part of the bio that really blows me away, he says it's estimated that over the past 30 years, more than 100,000 people have attended one of Mr. Tenney's signature weird lectures. And I was lucky to be in attendance at one of those in Portland. And I'll say this. This is the God's honest truth, folks. Maybe there's other people as jaded as I am, but I'm very jaded when I go to these conferences just because I've seen a lot of stuff over the years. And this is my job, so it's like I really don't have much patience to sit. But John's presentation was so entertaining and informative and thought-provoking. I was really blown away. It was like, wow, this is... You know, some people can still rock and roll, baby. This is awesome, you know. So I was really blown away. So he's got a new book out, The Theoretical Weirdo. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about his amazing career, talk about the state of the paranormal and all that good stuff. John Tenney, finally, welcome back to Banal of America. Well, welcome to Banal of America. You haven't been on before. Jesus.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me. This is your summer lecture series, right?
Yes, Summer of Strangeness.
Summer of Strangeness. Now, am I allowed to swear on this radio podcast broadcast?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you can swear all you want. Yeah, I'll be swearing. If I haven't already, I will soon, I'm sure.
Well, thank you for all the kind words. No, it was great to finally meet you, and thank you for, like, saying all that nice stuff. I feel like a lot of the times my lectures, I know that they're fun, and I know they're informative and stuff. I think that a lot of time in this field, though, like, so many people have PowerPoint presentations and a stock lecture that it's just, yeah. I think I was the only person at that weekend, right, that didn't stand at the podium.
Like, yeah, I didn't know if you had a microphone or anything. You were just like standing there talking. It was revelatory. It was awesome.
But I think that's good sometimes, like when you have to download a bunch of information, it's obviously really great to get a scholar who can download all that information to you. But at a certain point, and you know this, and your listeners know this, like, we're talking about really fucking weird shit, and you should be excited about it. Like, it's interesting and it's fun, and I feel like sometimes justice isn't done to the strangeness by standing still behind a podium for an hour and a half showing slides that you've shown 800 times.
Yeah, exactly. No, I know totally what you mean. I rarely do presentations, but by like the second one I did, I was like, I'm taking all of the words out of, I'm just doing pictures. I'm just doing pictures for this presentation, and I'll read the words like from what I know and my notes and everything. Because, as I was looking it over, I'm like, this is all too much. This is too much. Now, I guess give folks a little bit of the bio, the background. I gave kind of a... I gave the Amazon page bio, but tell people a little bit about who John Tenney is, and I keep now. Oxy, let me ask you this: the EL. I always call you John Tenney. You and I are a lot alike in a sense because people seem to refer to us just by our last name. So it's like, oh, it's Benal or it's Tenney. So I've always just think of you as Tenney. We're like the shares of the paranormal, but. But what's the EL? What is the EL?
So it started off as in the early 90s. Let me give you. I'll find a way to wrap this up kind of really quickly. In the early 90s, when I started working in television, there's an actor whose name is John Tenney, and all these like rules and guidelines and things about having actors that have the same names and having like people who are in documentaries that have the same names. And I don't think it works that way anymore, but in the late 80s and early 90s, like they wanted to have something so that people knew who was who. And so I am one of those people that has two middle names. I'm named after my dad, John, my grandfather, Elmer, and his father, Leonard. So I just threw the EL in there. Well, thankfully, the universe is strange enough, too, that I also study words, and I love etymology of words. And so when I started to realize that L was a pretty significant, strange word, it's the oldest name of God. The reason that it, all the archangels are Mike L, Raphael, Ariel, Oriel, even Elohim, like anything that has to do with God, there's an EL, even when the Superman was created, Ka-El and Jor-El, like it was all the Superman, it was the God-man. And so then I kind of latched on to really loving that my middle initials were EL.
Ah, gotcha. All right. Because I keep forgetting to say them. That's how it came up.
Just call me Tenney like everybody else does.
There you go. Well, who is Tenney? Give us the bio, the background. Give us sort of the thumbnail beyond the Amazon page.
Sure. So I'm born and raised in Michigan. I'm not one of those people that was abducted at 3 or 4 years old. I didn't see a ghost at 5 or 6. I was just a weird kid who liked to read weird books, and I grew up into the punk rock community in the 80s, and I hated people telling me what to say and how to think and what I could and couldn't think about. And I used to skip school and hang out at my local public library with this guy who ended up being Jack Kevorkian, and he was the first one who really kind of challenged the way that I thought about things and reality. And then my first real true actual mentor was a political assassination scholar. He studied political assassinations of the 1960s and 70s, and he led me to other mentors. And I thought, at some time I would probably grow up and just be a teacher and talk about folklore and government conspiracies. And when I was almost out of my teens, I had kind of a freak heart attack and died. And when I recovered from that, I wanted to use all of my skills to investigate strangeness and weirdness and what comes after. And so I went to college and started to become a major in folklore and religions. And then that was probably 91 or 92. I got a call asking if I wanted to be a researcher for Unsolved Mysteries. That was the first television show I worked on, and I dropped out of college, and I've just been this ever since.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. It's a pretty remarkable journey. There's a lot of stuff. I'm sure you get a lot of questions about Jack Kevorkian and that kind of thing. It's a very interesting winding road to what brought you here.
Yeah, for sure. Jack was I don't think people realize that Jack was as political a figure as he was. He was very into human rights. He was very into individual rights. Obviously, he thought, you know, if you were in a situation where there was no way out and you were just going to suffer for the rest of your life, you should have the option to take your own life. And that obviously that was very controversial. It still is. But that stemmed from his belief that, you know, there are certain things that you should and shouldn't be able to do. He was a big proponent of delegalizing marijuana and psychotropic drugs, and that stuff all gets lost in the he murdered people in his minivan or his
yeah, the caricature of who he was, yeah.
Right.
Now you get the new book out. I read the book this week. I really enjoyed it quite a bit. So I'm gonna sort of pull some stuff out of the book as we go along. Hopefully that's all right. You know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, this kind of it's right at the beginning of the book, but it really kind of resonated with me because I feel in a lot of ways the same way. I'm going to directly quote you here. You say and I'm sort of pulling a little bit out of the sentence, so there may be a clause here or there, but the gist of it is, I take a hard stance against the community to which I am mostly ashamed to belong to, which is I take it to be the paranormal community. As soon as I read that, I was like, highlight, like, yes, there's a certain, what I found refreshing about that is there's a certain self-awareness of the ridiculousness of this. I think a lot of this field, all of these fields kind of take themselves very seriously to the point where it's kind of, and act so ridiculously at the same time that it is, you know, we're on the fringe of the fringe here. This the paranormal. It's as I've said before. It's like if you become famous in this field, you're no more famous than like Hacksaw Jim Duggan or something like that.
Yeah,
famous,
absolutely.
Really.
Yeah, I doubt you'd even be as famous as Hacksaw Jim Duggan. But I mean, it is one of those things in this community. Like, I'll find somebody who writes or be friends with someone or see someone lecture that I think is like super insightful and like really great. And then like, you know, I'll go and they'll say like, they have a new book coming out. And so their book is covered in like drippy, bloody fonts. And then their book doesn't sound anything like the way they sound when I talk to them. And then I find out that, you know, someone that I've been talking to for 3 years is a completely terrible person who thinks that they know all of the answers to the universe. And if you don't believe in them, and like, I really do sometimes get super frustrated with this community. And a lot of the times, I mean, you always hear people talking about like, well, we don't want drama in the paranormal community. Like, you're going to have drama. Like, you have drama with your family and you see them,
yeah,
and you grew up with them. Like, this is a very loose network of people who interact infrequently on the internet. You're going to have drama. Like, that's just a necessary thing that's going to happen. But what we're dealing with, like you said, we're on the fringe of the fringe. We're talking about, like, monsters and robots and magic crystals and doing ritual spells. Like, we're talking about some really fucking crazy stuff. And, yes, there's a serious side to it, but you have to be able to laugh. That's an important side to it. And you have to also understand that nobody knows what the fuck they're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a point you drive home in the book a lot, and I totally agree with. There's an unnecessary reticence from people in this field, in all the fields, really. You know, we speak of the paranormal, all of them, really, to just say you don't know. Just what's wrong with saying you don't know? Like, we don't know. If we knew, we wouldn't be doing this. So that's why I get frustrated, really, with, like, some of the UFO people who were like, we know the aliens are coming here. It's like, we don't know that. We don't know anything about these fucking UFOs, dude. We don't know anything about them. So anyone who says otherwise really, you know, doesn't know what they're talking about. But, yeah, so
yeah,
people need to be able to say, I don't know.
They need to be able to say, I don't know. And, again, like, I can't stress to people enough. When someone starts in this field, whether it's cryptozoology or ufology or ghosts or, you know, psychic phenomena, remote viewing, magic, witchcraft, whatever, when someone starts telling you definitive, declarative statements, this is a ghost, that is a demon, this is an extraterrestrial, this ritual works 100% of the time. If somebody says stuff like that, that person can be very problematic in your life.
Yeah. Extrapolate on that, though, because that's very definitive. I like it, but go on.
So it leads to someone, you know, I don't have a problem with contactees. I'll take contactees as an example. Contactees have very rich experiences all across the board, all across historically. They have these very strange experiences, and I think those experiences are individualized and personalized, and that's why sometimes they don't make sense. In most cases, they don't make sense, but they make sense to the individual. Well, when the individual starts to think that they're the special person who understands everything behind the experience, and that you don't understand your experience because you don't see it through their lens, and they start telling you, but the aliens, I'm the only one the aliens talk to. This is how you start to form cults, and this is how you start getting cultish thinking. And once you have a leader whose word is infallible, you're no longer allowed to speculate and theorize yourself. And so you've trapped yourself.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. At the risk of drawing too much ire from the UFO crowd, I feel like seeing that nowadays in UFO world where speculation is verboten, but
well, yeah, and speculation is not allowed a lot of the times in you know, it's so crazy because you do have these like diehard, like I'm now, I guess, one of the older UFO crowd. I'm almost 50. I've been doing this for 30 years, so I guess I'm one of the old guys now, but it's so strange to me that there's this old crowd that's seen as blocking the way for the new UFO community, when in essence the old crowd is saying, like, you just need to slow down for a second and look at what's happening, because we were in your position before and we fell on our faces over and over and over again. We don't want that to happen with you. And the new community is like, get out of our way. You don't know what you're talking about. We're better than you. We have better stuff than you. Get out of our way. And there's I don't find anything wrong with saying take your time. Like, this shit isn't going away.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think what I liked a lot about the book too is just even from you know, you were talking about your background and everything. I was on Nate Brislin's show last night. We taped the show. It should be sometime coming out soon. But I was sort of talking about sort of how I made my path in all this, and I think we have a mutual sort of agreement that it's like you gotta know the history of all this. You gotta know the people who built the giants upon whose shoulders we stand. I think that's really important, and I think you have an appreciation for that old guard who paved the road so guys like us could be around for a long time.
For sure. And here's something else, too, which I found very interesting and I've been seeing a lot of lately, and it's unfortunate, which is I don't have a problem with someone saying I'm wrong. Like, I know that I'm not right about a lot of stuff. I openly admit I don't know what's going on. So for someone to challenge my ideas, like, please, I want to be smarter. I want to have better ideas. The difficulty for me comes in the fact where there are people who, when you want to challenge them, they feel completely fine challenging anyone else that is outside of themselves. But if you speculate or challenge their ideas, then you become pariah to that person or that group of people. And that's always been very curious to me. I really don't understand. We talked about this a little bit off the air. I really don't understand, like, people who want to be famous in this field.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Doesn't make any sense. How the most famous people in the world in this field, first of all, are unknown to most people throughout the world. And for the people who do know who they are, half of them think that they're a fraud, and the other half are like, yeah, that guy's okay. That's fame.
Yeah, I didn't even think of that. Yeah, yeah. Half the people that know them, yeah, think they're, yeah. Yeah. Well, it's kind of like, what do you want to, I don't get what there is to achieve by becoming, you know, as we call it on the show, UFO famous, you know? To me, it's like, I've said this many times on the show, it's like, all you end up doing is sort of like, you end up being on the circuit and doing books. If that's what you want to do, like write books and be on the circuit, I guess that's cool. But to me, it's like, I don't, yeah, there's no, UFO famous is like an illusion. It's really not. You don't really become. You're just a really large fish in a tiny little puddle.
Yeah, I mean, so all I really know is my own life, and my path has been, I researched all this stuff and lectured on all this stuff and investigated all this stuff and worked on a lot of stuff. Now, while I was working for Unsolved Mysteries as a researcher, like, I was also a custodian in a high school because I needed to make money. And, you know, I worked normal jobs the entire time I was researching and lecturing. And I got to a point where I had saved up enough money to actually buy a house so that I didn't have a mortgage. And when I was like, you know what, I bought a house, I just have to cover my bills, I think that I'm going to just spend the rest of my life kind of living this dream of talking about weird stuff with weird people, and maybe that'll work out. Like, that is in my brain, like, the best case scenario. Like, I don't have a real job. I haven't since 2010. So for 10 years... But the only reason that I can do that is because I scrubbed toilets and drove school buses and worked in junior highs as a parapro for kids with learning disabilities.
Right, yeah, dude,
you
hustled,
up my
man.
Money.
You hustled. You've done tons of lectures and everything. I mean, just even in the paranormal realm, it's like, I think that's another thing that people don't, like, first of all, you're never going to get rich in this field. That's, like, not going to happen. And again, as we've said, you'll become famous within the bubble. And it's like, even if you want to do that, I think people get frustrated. They think it's so easy. It's like, it's not easy. You got to work your ass off, like, double time probably in this field to make ends meet, because it's just not really – like, some of these people, they, you know, they'll start up a podcast or they don't make it, or they'll start up a Patreon or whatever and it doesn't take off. And it's like, you would – the energy you've put into this, if you could have picked any other topic, you probably would have been successful – like, actually successful, like, where it would become your job. Like, if you had a podcast on cricket, there's enough people who would probably support a cricket podcast. I'm sure there are people that support a cricket podcast. There's room for one more, I guess, is what I'm saying. But with this field, it's very, very hard like I said, make ends meet, pretty much.
Well, I had a conversation with someone this week, and they said something about being famous and researching this stuff, and I was talking about, you know, it took me a long time, and I spent many years doing lectures to empty libraries to get to this point where I get to do this every day, and this is my life now. And they said, well, I want to be famous, like, you know, be able to write books and be as well regarded as, like, Jacques Vallée. And I said, okay, but I was like, okay, that's fine, but before you become a UFO researcher, you need to get your PhD in computer sciences and become a computer scientist. Like there's work involved as a normal person before. Nobody just, like, one day says, I'm going to do this for the rest of my life, and then researches UFOs, and that's all they ever do. You know? And they said,
right,
well, okay, not Jacques Vallée, like Alan Hynek. And I was like, okay, then get a PhD in astronomy. Like work went into being able to be UFO famous.
Exactly. I sound like an old timer now, but, like, nowadays it's like, you know, the first step shouldn't be just to have a logo. Like, the logo should be. That's why when people check out my shit, it's all shitty stuff made in paint, and it's run on HTML, my website, because it's like, I just do the shit and put it out, and if people want to hear it, great. You know, I don't. The slickness to me is that should be the last thing you worry about. But, you
well,
know, I'm an old
you,
fart at this
you,
point, I guess.
If you want to be you, the other thing is, too, is here's, you know, the kind of unspoken rule. And this is, you know, one of those things that everybody knows but very few people talk about, which is, if you do want to be famous in the cryptozoological community, like famous, or if you want to be famous in the ghost community, if you want to be famous in the UFO community, then lie.
Yeah, no shit.
Don't do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't do any real research. Just lie about stuff. Because when you lie, you can say any shit you want to, and it'll be hyperbolic, and people will want to hear about it, and someone will want to give you a television show. And just realize, and just realize that at some point, though, if your lie is found out, your life in this community is over.
Yeah. It's, yeah, that's a, yeah. You need, yeah, beyond, maybe even if you don't want to lie, it's like you have to be insanely sensational. You have to, like, come up with the most grandiose, like, the crazier, you know, you take a hard left into crazy if you really want to sort of gin up a lot of interest, I find. A lot of people who achieve a certain level of notoriety are attached to some of the zaniest shit. You know, so.
Well, that's the thing, too, is, and you know this, and this is, again, this is something that I think a lot of people talk about but never really gets discussed that often in the general public, which is when you do that, too, when you become the kind of individualized researcher who has the crazy story and you're being hyperbolic and you're making up some stuff and maybe you got some real good stuff on one side that's actually not made up but you want to accent it a little bit, like, you're in that by yourself. And when you're in that place by yourself, you will go mad. Like, you'll go insane. I've seen that in the UFO community, in the ghost community, in all of the paranormal communities. Like, people will just go crazy, and because no one is there to pull them out, they start to believe their own bullshit.
Yeah.
And then they're just gone.
It's it's very interesting. It's quite a field of interesting cats, that's for sure. That's for sure. But it's I'm going to pivot here, and we'll probably circle back to this paranormal community stuff, but I want to talk a little bit about some of this other stuff in the book. Now, one of the things, this was like, and I presume, like, I don't think maybe, this may be wholly your own, something you came up with, but I presume maybe somebody has offered this as an idea before, but this is the first time I considered it in reading your book, was this idea that, like, when you really kind of break down ghost hunting, we're going to pivot a little to ghost hunting now, when you break down this ghost hunting thing, like, it shouldn't make any sense. Like, if you're talking to this ghost, like, theoretically, like, where the ghost, we know how sound is made, so it shouldn't, the way the sound is being received theoretically by whatever the presence is not the way we think it is, because it's not the way it is for us, but we somehow transpose that onto whatever the force is. I might have butchered all that, but I think you got, they don't have ears. That's the point you make. Ghosts don't have ears.
Yeah, they don't have ears, they don't have mouths, they don't have hands. And so we apply our seemingly shared realities logic onto ghosts, and it becomes completely illogical. Like, people can hear me because my throat pushes air through it and vibrates the air, and then it vibrates your ear, and then you hear me. Like, a ghost doesn't have a mouth to push air. Like, it doesn't have a throat or a larynx or lungs, as far as we know. It doesn't have hands to move anything. When you see something move, people are like, oh, a ghost moved that. Can you turn that flashlight on? Like, they don't have fingers to press buttons to turn flashlights on and off. They don't have, I mean, you know, as a science fiction and kind of horror fan, I remember when I was, you know, 12 or 13 years old talking to a guy at a comic shop, and he explained to me that, like, the Invisible Man doesn't work because the Invisible Man's eyes are invisible, which means they don't reflect light, so he's blind. Like, your retinas and eyes have to reflect and refract light so that you can see, and if the Invisible Man's eyes are invisible, he's blind, so he can't see. So I was like, oh, so ghosts would be blind too. Or they experience it on a completely different and unknown parallel reality to ours and somehow manipulate us into experiencing them. And that's not how people think that ghost hunting works. They think that grandma's quasi-invisible body is walking around in the building, still being grandma and still doing the things that grandma did. And that's a possibility, but it seems pretty unlikely.
Yeah, exactly, because there's a lot of, like, physicality where you think, it, like, if you really think more about it, like I said, it's kind of what put the seed in my head was that ear stuff in the book, where it's like, that other side has to be, you know, I would presume it has to have some kind of, like, there are less rules or something, you know, there are less sort of, like, the laws of physics maybe somehow don't apply or something, I don't know, but it's a very, you know, I don't even think we can fathom it. In a sense, but it's something like,
well,
very weird.
And if you apply physicality in any sense to them, if you say that they're still, like, their human essence or whatever is still over there and still has arms and eyes and clothes and, they're still somewhat human, like, then you have to apply, like, you're picking and choosing which things you can apply, because people will say, like, oh, there's a ghost boy in this house, and he's 5 years old, and he died 100 years ago, and people talk to him like he's five. But, like, if there is physicality, like, didn't he grow up on the other side? Isn't he 105 years old now? Like, why would his mentality have been locked into that position forever? You know, the five-year-old Tim doesn't exist anymore. You're not 5 years old anymore. That five-year-old you is, in essence, gone and dead. Something like five-year-old Tim still exists. It's just an older, more well-read, better comprehending philosophical version. And so if you die and all of a sudden can experience reality not locked and tethered into your biological body, like, of course your experience and your mind and your ideas are going to change and grow. And so why would you think they're the exact same person 100 years later that they were 100 years ago?
Yeah, it's confounding. Now, I'm going to ask you a question. Now, this came up once when I was talking to Rosemary Ellen Guiley, and it's always kind of fascinated me. I haven't heard many people explore this idea. It popped into my head when I was talking to her a long time ago. This kind of combines two realms that you're well familiar with, conspiracy and this ghosts and the afterlife. Now, do you think, because we hear all this stuff about, oh, the government should tell us what they know about UFOs and everything, do you think the government or, you know, some you know, nefarious, or not necessarily nefarious, but some cabal, some cadre, some, not necessarily like a mystic, but like the powers that be, some pocket of the powers that be, if you will, set all that up. Do you think they know what happens when you die? Like, is that like some secret you think that is kept by either the government or handed down in time by maybe secret societies or something like that?
I mean, I would hope so. I would hope that, I talk about this at my lectures sometimes. Like, the first thing that should have happened when there were, like, three sentient cavemen, like, walking around, like, and they had self-awareness, like, the first thing that should have happened when one of the three died, when one, like, fell down on the ground, boom, and was dead, the other two at that point should have been like, what the fuck just happened to him? Is that going to happen to me? Let's start studying this shit right now. And right? Like, that should have been prime goal of humans, like, aside from staying alive and eating and procreating, like, figure out what the fuck happens when you die. But the default, it seems, historically was like, dig a hole and plant him in the ground like a seed, maybe he'll grow again. And now, you know, 500,000 years later, we're still digging holes and putting people in them as if that means something. Like, yeah. I would hope that there's a group, a society, a cabal, someone, somewhere that actually held the secret. But the reality is I don't think that – I think that there are some things that are supposed to be unknown to us. And I think that what comes after this seemingly shared reality is one of those mysteries. I think that the world is supposed to contain mysteries – so that we can dialogue and engage with each other about those mysteries. I think that's why it's so important to talk about this stuff. Not that we solve it, but that we use it as a mechanism to discuss our inner deepest feelings with each other.
Yeah, that makes sense. Absolutely, yeah. I think what spawned that a lot was that Kevin Bacon movie. That wasn't that the whole theme of the movie, like that they were going to die to try and find out what was on the other side. It turned into like a thriller or something like that. Do you know what movie I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah, Flatliners.
Yes, yes. Part of me wonders. You know, it's like that. You know, it's like, oh, the government, they did all kinds of crazy fucking experiments, like since World War II. I figure they must have, at the very least, if some ancient cabal didn't know, I figure the government at some point during their most nefarious over the last, like, 60, 70 years, must have tried to do it. But who knows?
I'm sure that they have tried to do it, and I'm sure that, I mean, the way that, if anything, like, let's, I like to play these thought games. I mean, that's kind of the idea behind Theoretical Weirdo, is that we live in this community where it's okay to theorize. Like, we're not a hard science. Like, there's no rules. We're allowed to go to strange places with our thoughts. And the thing that I've always wondered about is not if they know what comes after death. But I've always thought to myself, how much would they keep us from knowing that there's nothing after this life? Let's say that they knew definitively that thousands of years ago, all of these groups, and then even more recently with high technology and experiments, like the governments of the world and the religions of the world, knew that once you die, you're just fucking dead, and there's nothing else after it forever. Like, what would they do to keep us from knowing that? Because if that's true, if there's no God, if there's no spirit world, if once you die, you're dead, then all bets are off the fucking table. Like, you might as well do whatever the fuck you want right now. And that's chaos and pandemonium.
Yeah, that's an interesting scenario. Absolutely. Yeah.
You don't want 7 billion people doing anything that they want to because they know that there's not any kind of reward or punishment.
That's just a terrifying scenario, just like for me, just to think about, because like that is, I wouldn't necessarily be that. If that like was if they had death disclosure tomorrow. And all that came out, I wouldn't be one of the people who freaked out and, like, started doing anything terrible. I probably would just be, like, really fucking depressed. I'd be like, shit, well, I'm already 40. What the fuck? Now you're telling me.
Right.
I'm banking on afterlife, dude. I'm banking on that. I can't.
But the thing is there would be a lot of people. There are a lot of people. There are atheists right now who believe, like, okay, so we should take the time to be nice to each other, and we should take the time to smell the roses, and we should take the time to admire the beauty and the delicateness of life and the fragility of life, because it's going to be over soon. But if you told all of the earth and everyone on it, there's fucking nothing, like, once you're gone, nothing, do whatever you want, there are going to be a lot more people who don't want to take the time and smell the flowers. There are going to be a lot more people who want to see what it's like to fucking kill people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or get revenge that they, you know, all that shit.
Yeah.
All kinds of people. Yeah. It would be frightening. Yeah. Then you'd have like the crazy people who just, then you'd have like a mad dash, of like the super rich and shit to figure out how to keep prolong life as long as possible. So it would be an interesting,
right.
That would be a good sci-fi movie.
I mean, that is the reality though, right? Like the rich people immediately would sink all of their money into how can I keep myself alive longer? And then we would get some terrible, like eventually the technology would leak down to people like us and we'd get some terrible, like, you know, glitchy software that we would have to, our families would have to pay for forever to keep our minds alive in a terrible, you know, Perl Apache server somewhere.
Yeah, like it's just a terrible simulation thing that, yeah. Well, that's depressing. Now this is a little deeper. Now we kind of pivot back to the sort of paranormal research in general. I really like you advocate for a philosophical approach to paranormal research. It's kind of a little bit kind of what we're doing tonight, but just sort of this idea of maybe just taking a broader look at all this and not necessarily getting so in the weeds on it. I find that really is refreshing with this field, because I think once you kind of are too burrowed down into the real nitty gritty, you kind of can lose the forest for the trees.
Yeah, I, you know, every year, except for this year, but, you know, I will sometimes host or be there while there are these kind of large conference ghost hunts going on. And I always tell people, like, don't worry about your camera and your tape recorder and your EMF meter. Like, that stuff is fine. If you want to do that, obviously, please go ahead and do that. But, like, your best photograph isn't going to be proof of anything to anyone but you. Your best recording isn't going to be proof of anything to anyone but you. Like, because we're not doing science. Like, we're just experimenting. We're doing it very loosely. Nobody has controls. Nobody's going for reproducibility. No one's going for falsifiability. Like, what we should be doing is go on a ghost hunt, and then we should be having kind of roundtables after we're done where we're being fantasophical, where we talk about well, what did that mean? What was that feeling when you heard that thing? What was that experience? Did you have any imagery? Like, we should be talking deeply about this very important subject, because that's where I feel this community can make a breakthrough. When we start to realize that, you know, life is precious and that we don't really know what happens after we die. Like, those are the questions we should be discussing, not, you know, getting, like you said, in the weeds about, well, is the mag light just turning on because the coil is heating, or is a ghost actually influencing the electromagnetic field? That's very clinical and not very fun and interesting to me. What's fun and interesting to me is, what was that feeling when you thought that you were getting a response from someone in the afterworld? How did that make you feel? How did that connect with you on a deeper emotional level and psychological level? Because this is how I feel about it. And then you get into very deep and honest, open conversations. Like, I do think that we need to be more speculative, more deep thinking, and together we construct much larger ideas than we can do by ourselves.
Yeah, because, like, in the book you introduced, in the ears discussion, you sort of put forward the idea that, like, okay, so maybe this force, for lack of a better term, is instead of all the energy it would take for it to manifest in front of you, it could just kind of, like, ping the part of your brain that remembers your grandmother or whatever. It's sort of like the discussion then should really be, like, okay, instead of, like, oh, what did your grandmother look like or whatever, or, like, did she say anything? It's maybe you should be, like, asking yourself, like, okay, why did I just see that? Like, why did that just happen, you know?
Right. And we have to realize, too, like, if two people are standing in a hallway and they see a woman in white in the hallway, like, we don't know, and this is just the reality of, you know, our subjective and perspective realities. Like, we don't know if they're both seeing the same woman in white. Like, if I see a red ball bouncing down the street and you see a red ball bouncing down the street and I say, oh, I saw a red ball, and you say, oh, I saw a red ball, we immediately think that we saw the same red ball. But but there's no proof that we saw the same red ball. I might have seen one that was bouncing down the street, and then I talk to you later, and I'm like, when did you see that? And you're like, oh, I saw it, you know, at 4 o'clock. And I'm like, oh, I saw mine at 6 in the morning. Like, it's obviously not the same red ball. But we immediately jump to the idea that, oh, we both heard the same voice. Oh, we both saw the same figure. Like, we don't even know if that's true because we're not having deep discussions with each other.
How many of these ghost hunts have you been on, would you say, at this point in your life?
Group or group and individual, like, cases?
I guess just, I guess all together. I mean, I guess if you're in search of spirits, let's say. So I guess it would encompass all of that.
In search of spirits, I mean, that's a good question, actually. I don't think I've ever sat down to figure that out. It's got to be, I don't know, in the past 30 years, a couple thousand.
So you have a lot of experience with that. that was kind of the point. Now, I've only done like two or three of these, and I feel like I didn't have the constitution for it. But I guess for a neophyte, like, what do you find is the best approach to take? And I know obviously it sort of differs for every person, but I guess what has worked for you? Because, like, the first one I did sort of like, I just mimicked the TV show like everyone else does.
Right.
So, you know,
right.
I walked around with the thing, I talked, I asked questions. So the second time, like a year later, I was like, all right, that's bullshit. So let's revisit this. And so then I just walked around the place and didn't say anything, and at one point just sat in a chair for a while, but I still didn't experience anything. So it was like, all right, maybe there's another technique I could, you know, maybe there's something else I'm missing here.
I mean, I think that last thing that you said is very close, because when I do groups, and a lot of times people will show up because they've seen it on television, and so they want to hunt like they see on television, which is fine. That's all they know. But I tell people who will come to my group, or they'll come into where I'm investigating, and I tell people, like, your body is a very strangely tuned machine to intercepting information. You, throughout your normal daily life, you will walk into a restaurant or a location and you'll get a weird feeling, or you'll know that someone is staring at you. You can feel them like staring at you, or you'll get a creepy feeling. And so I tell people, like, if you've never been on a ghost hunt before, recently I was at, this is last year, I was at a place called Belvoir Winery in Missouri. And I told people we were in a graveyard, and it was outside, and it was at night, and there's dogs in the neighborhood, and there's a road nearby. And I said, listen, none of your recording equipment is going to be any good. There's too much wind. There's dogs barking. There's cars. So you're not going to use your recorders. What I want you to do is I want you to walk around this graveyard, and I want you to just pay attention to your body. And notice that as you're walking through the graveyard, sometimes your gait will slow, and you'll slow down walking when you get near or away from something. Go back to that place where you slowed down and spend a minute. Get down. Try and open yourself up mentally and psychologically that maybe something is happening. And I think that's a really good place to go. I mean, I'm not an enormous fan of Hans Holzer, the kind of ghost hunting grandfather of this community. But the one of the times that I met him, I had a Geiger counter and I had a flashlight and I had a tape recorder. And he said to me, what are you going to do with all that stuff? And I said, I'm going to catch a ghost. And he laughed and he said, someday you're going to grow up. You're going to throw that shit away and you're going to allow yourself to have an experience. And that's some true shit. Like, yeah. If you're spending all your time looking at the beeping machine and the flashing lights, like, something might be right in front of you saying, like, fucking look at me, but you don't see him because you're worried about getting it on tape.
Right, right, exactly. Yeah, absolutely. And that sort of, I get why people do it. It's cool, I guess, but I grew very cynical about, like, a little machine that, like, goes through the, you know, that picks up the words and shit. So it's like, all right, that's why I kind of just got up and walked around. So I think that might be, and I don't know if I thought about it then. I hope I did, but part of me from talking to you is like, well, I think maybe when you're in that space, like, you should, if some random thought crosses your mind, like, that's worth noting. That might be something that, you know, if all of a sudden you think of something completely random, it's like, well, shit, why did I just think of that? That might be more profound than an EVP or something.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it's been asked, doing a lot of ghost hunts with a lot of groups and stuff, at certain points, you know, I'll get the group together and we'll do a group electronic voice phenomena session, a group EVP session, because I like to feel that everybody working together has more power to push something into another reality than just me. But a lot of times people will ask me after the EVP session, why did you ask that really weird question about mittens? Or why did you ask that really weird question about popcorn? Or why did you ask that really weird question about rabbits? And I'll tell them, because we were sitting around in the dark in a hotel in the middle of winter, and for some reason, popcorn came into my mind, and I don't know why. And so I just asked, does it have something to do with popcorn? Did you like popcorn? Like, exactly what you were saying. Like, why did this random thought pop into my head? Did someone else put it there and wants to talk about it? And it's important that we pay attention to ourselves, because we're part of the interaction.
What I thought was interesting, too, it kind of, like, opened my eyes, a lot like the ear thing. It's one of those things where it's, like, it's common sense until you – it's not common sense until you hear it. Then it's, like, why didn't I fucking think of that before? This is from your book here, Theoretical Weirdness. What made me think about this? I'm building up to something. Building up to something here. Was that you said – you made the observation that – like, you see all this stuff, and even the ghost hunts I've been on, and I'm guessing, like, the vast majority of ones that you've done, they're all at nighttime, and it's like there's no reason. We don't know, like, there's no indication whatsoever that we're aware of, that I'm aware of, that you can't just do this in the daytime. Like, maybe, who the fuck knows? Maybe you have better results in the daytime. Who knows? But nobody does it in the daytime.
the trope of hunting ghosts at night really began with television, with popular culture in movies and television, and it's because it's spooky. And if you talk to ghost hunters now, they'll tell you, the majority of them will say, like, well, we investigate at night because it's quieter, because there's less traffic, the neighbors are asleep, there's less planes flying overhead, there's less contamination, they'll tell you this. But at the same time, like, when you're in the dark and in the quiet, your brain will create imagery and sounds because it lacks imagery and sounds. So at a psychological level, it's actually a pretty bad time to investigate because your brain is looking around in the darkness trying to make sense of the darkness, and your ears are reaching out in the darkness trying to find any sound. And when you're in your mindset, when you're trying to find a ghost, like that stuff, it psychologically can really be misinformed. There's no good reason to investigate only at night. I investigate a lot during the day. There are places that for me are a lot more active during the day than at night. I've investigated this place called Pennhurst Asylum in Pennsylvania multiple times, and I don't investigate it at night. They'll have night investigations, and I'll say, I'll do the day investigations. No one wants to do the day investigations because the day investigations aren't scary. But we end up with the best results because I take everybody into what was the cafeteria, and in the middle of the day, we try to have interactions. And when Pennhurst was being used as an asylum, during the day is when it was active. At night, people were restrained and told to be quiet all night long. Now you walk in there, and it's almost as if the ghosts do have a memory of what they were told. And you walk in there at night, and you're like, talk to me, talk to me, talk to me. Any person that was at Pennhurst was told to shut up and be quiet at night.
Yeah, yeah. That makes sense, yeah. So what I was building up to here, here's what I'm going to do.
Okay.
I've taken to walking in the last, like, week and a half. And I think I'm over the hump now of where it's like for me at least, where it's like I have to do it a few times. And now I've kind of gotten a rhythm where it's like, all right, now I walk every day. So there's a very large – I've expanded my radius of I walk. First it was like a half mile, then it grew to more and more miles. So now I'm – walking like 4 or 5 miles a day. So now within my radius is a very large graveyard that I could easily walk around in. So I'm going to, in the next, week or two, maybe even tomorrow, it's Saturday, I have a lot of time. So I'm going to sort of put some of these ideas into practice, and I'll walk to the graveyard, and I'll just walk around. It'll be in the daytime because I don't fucking walk around at night. not that you can't, but, it's dangerous, I think. There's coyotes in my town and everything else, so I don't want wild raccoons and whatnot. You don't want to run around walking around my town at night. So, and teenagers, which are the most dangerous game of all. But, so I will do – I'm gonna sort of put some of these ideas we've talked about into practice, and I'll have my phone with me, so if anything crazy happens, I'll tweet it out to people. But yeah, I think that the idea of not overlooking the daytime, changing that paradigm, is a really interesting sort of avenue to explore.
Well, it goes right back to that idea that there's some kind of parallel between our reality and the one that seems to exist with ghosts. I mean, the idea that ghosts are sitting around waiting for it to get dark before they start talking to anyone. Most people sleep during the night, right? So if they're holding over any of their humanity after they pass over, wouldn't they be asleep too in the middle of the night? And you're waking them up? Maybe that's why their answers are so disjointed at night. You're waking someone up out of slumber and they're talking to you, but I don't know. Who are you?
Yeah.
Like, maybe that's why ghosts at night speak so strangely. Yeah, I can't tell you. I worked on television shows. When I was on the television show Ghost Stalkers in 2014, every place that we investigated, we also investigated during the day, and none of it was ever shown on television.
Right.
Not spooky.
Wow. You would think that, like, I don't know. Well, let's talk a little bit sort of about that experience, because I have that in my notes, so we'll, since you brought it up. But you would think, this question can kind of segue into the discussion, but, like, you would think, like, where the fuck's the imagination, man? We obviously, well, you're in it, but obviously we both love Hellyer's. Like, a lot of shit happens in the daytime in Hellyer's. They're doing shit throughout the 24/7 show. Like, you would think some of these cable shows would at least have the imagination to try to do it differently. Like, why is it just so intellectually lazy to just keep doing the overnight thing?
Because most of the shows are run by network executives who don't believe in any of this in any way, shape, or form. They're put together by crews of people who don't believe in any of this any way, shape, or form. They're trying to do it as fast and as cheap as possible, and they know that if it's spooky, people will watch it. And they're not trying to educate anybody. That's the other thing, too, when you talk about, like, television shows as a way to educate people, especially into the supernatural. Like, the most watched paranormal television show has, like, 2 million viewers. That's it, right? And then you figure half of them are watching because they like horror movies and they like spooky stuff, which leaves, you know, maybe 1 million people who watch it because they're actually interested in ghosts. That's a very small target demographic audience. So they don't want to spend a ton of money trying to get people to think about stuff. On an episode of Ghost Stalkers, I'll give you an example. We were in a location and someone had seen what they claimed to be a kind of goat man in the location, or the form of a goat man. And after we had filmed the episode, the network came to me and said, "We want to do a voiceover where you explain goat men." And so I said, "Okay, give me a day or so." So I put together like 3 or 4 paragraphs about the mythology behind goat men and Bahamut and Pan and all of these goat men throughout history and what they mean and how they relate and what they could symbolize.
Yeah.
And at the end of my closing paragraph was something to the effect of, "But in modern day and due to the hyperbolic nature of television, goat men are thought of as demons." And when the television show aired, they literally used just the last sentence of the 3 paragraphs. They showed a picture of Bahamut, and you just hear my voice go, "People think that goat men are demons."
Oh, my God. Oh, Jesus.
And that
now,
was all they
used. So, let's sort of, if you don't mind, let's, like, break a little bit of the fourth wall on this, because everybody...
Sure.
You know, everybody fucking wants to have a TV show. That's their whole, for a lot of these folks, that's kind of like, that's our Grandpa Simpson shakes fist at cloud
right.
idea here of these folks who just want to be on, who just want a TV show. But like, so what was it like being on the thing? You didn't like, from what happened, what you just said, this wasn't like your show. They just brought you in, had you do this shit, and then got rid of you, right? And then made the show, you know, you were like, I don't want to say.
No, we actually.
You, how did it work?
So a lot of the times what happens is I was contacted, like, "Do you want to do a show? We're going to do a show with you and this other guy, Chad. And you guys are going to investigate locations, and you've had a death experience, Chad had a near-death experience, so we're going to investigate ghosts, and that's going to be kind of the arc of the story." And I said, "Well, that's cool. That's a cool kind of arc." And I said, "Plus, Chad has never investigated, ever. He's done, like, 3, like, hosted ghost events, so he's never really investigated properly. And then I'm kind of old and jaded. I've done this for, at that time, 25 years. So that'll be a cool dichotomy, like, a cool thing to watch as well." I said, "Plus, I only want to go to places," and I actually, there's a lot of input on this show. I said, "Plus, I want to go to places that have never been seen on television. We're going to investigate during the day. I'm going to investigate one night by myself. Chad will investigate one night by himself. We don't want any camera crews. Nobody's allowed to be on set. We will be our own cameramen. I don't want anyone around to be able to screw with us." And that is where the problems really started, because when you watch a paranormal show, there's usually, you know, someone investigating, but they have a cameraman and a sound man with them. So that's 3 people in the location.
Right.
If you take a show where you've got 3 people investigating, Now you've got the three investigators, three cameramen, and three soundmen, so you've got 9 people in the building. That's even more contamination for investigation. Plus, you've probably got a craft service table outside with a director, a producer, and a showrunner outside. So that's 4 more people outside. So when we really went to the network and said, listen, it's just going to be Chad and I. Like, we're going to be the only people. They were very wary about that. We got into big fights over the fact that we would have to get credits as cameramen because, like, union rules state we couldn't be cameramen and all this stuff.
Oh, God, yeah. I didn't even think of that.
Yeah, it was really crazy, but we went in, we found really good stuff, and when I started seeing, so all of the voiceovers in television shows, this is breaking the fourth wall for everybody, all of the voiceovers are done, you film the investigation, let's say it takes 4 days to film an episode, you give all of the footage to whoever's going to, the network usually has a company that's going to edit it. They edit the show together. Then you get a rough cut of it. And like for me and Chad, we would write notes about the rough cut. Maybe you need to show this. Maybe you need to show that. And then I would start also writing my narration for the episodes. Then you'd see another rough cut or a final cut and you'd do your narration and then it would just air that way. Well, what happened is, is after Chad and I saw what they were doing, I think about 3 episodes in, and the way that they were cutting it and editing it, one of the things we would do is we would start submitting our voiceovers like the day before the episode would actually air. And that would give them no time. That would give them no time to edit our voices. They had to get it on the air, so they were just taking like raw cuts of us and putting it on. So it was actually the last 3 episodes are actually a lot more real in a sense because no one could fuck around with our audio. I mean, it was a good experience, but I have obviously problems with any television show. I was asked to do a spinoff of Paranormal State. And, you know, we got to a location and I walked in the house and this was one of those productions where there's cameramen and soundmen and directors and showrunners. And I walked into the house and the first thing I knew within 30 minutes of being in the house was the family had a lot of abuse issues, both psychological and drug abuse issues, that the house, whether or not it was haunted, the last thing this family needed were people telling them that their house was haunted. And I went outside and I told the producer of the show, I said, listen, this family needs therapy. They need counselors. There needs to be an intervention. They do not need ghost hunters in their house right now. And the producer told me, I need you to go in that house, John, and tell them that there's a demon in their house. And
what?
I told him
Holy
I quit.
Shit.
I told him I quit. And he told me I couldn't. They told me they'd sue me for $1 million. I literally walked 4 miles back to my hotel and flew home the next day. And then that show was never made.
Wow. And they didn't sue you for $1 million, right?
No, I mean, we went back and forth where my response to their emails was constantly, I do not have $1 million. Go ahead and sue me for $1 million. Like, you're never going to get it.
Right. And plus the whole thing, I'd love to see the court case, like, comes up where it's like he wouldn't go in there and tell them that their house is haunted by a demon. It's like how can any jury find fault in that? It's like,
well,
Jesus
and they would have to reveal that they manipulate television shows like that.
Exactly. All right, so that's interesting. So
anyway, I'm not the darling honey. I'm not the darling honey of television networks. I'll tell you that right now. I am so problematic to them because of this weird amount of integrity and morals that I have. They do not like it. It's terrible to say that, but it's true. I had a network contact me and they said, listen, we want to do a show with you. You can do anything you want. Let's do it. And so I had a cameraman come out. We filmed a sizzle reel, a little kind of proof of concept. It was exactly what I wanted to do. We submitted it to the network. They said, we love it. It's awesome. Let us have a little while to sit with it and run it past everybody. A month went by. Let us have it for another month. Another month goes by. Like the third month goes by. They're like, we love it. And I said, well, what's going on? And they said, well, we think it needs a monster.
Wow.
And I told them, I said, there's no monster in this, though. And they're like, well, we want a monster. And I said, well, then I don't want to do the show. And network people are so strange. Like, the fact that someone says to them, like, fuck it, I don't want to do it, I don't want to be on television, is something that they hear so infrequently that just was so startling to them. Like, what do you mean you don't want to be on television? I was like, I don't need to be on television. I live a perfectly fine life doing what I do. Like, I don't need to go on television and lie and manipulate people. Like, I don't fucking want to do it. And they're like, okay, we'll do it your way. And I'm like, no, it's fucking done. I'm out. I don't want to even work with you.
We gotta spread this stuff around. Let's put it on the internet.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Great heavens. What kind of radio show is this?